This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Call the play on the show.
Casualties of those trash can banging, sign stealing, video monitor using, seed spitting Houston Astros. Two managers gone from their jobs. AJ Hinch fired after being suspended. Alex Cora mutually agreeing to go away, which is okay, fine. I'll just leave. I'm not going to be around here. And a third, Carlos Beltran of the Mets, who was a player with the Astros, he's in some hot water. One of the league's best general managers has been fired, and Houston's first world championship in the sport now has an Astro-isk.
Oh, that was so bad.
So many times.
It was so bad.
I practiced it so many times. It has an Astro-isk. It has an Astro-isk.
You're the absolute worst. You come in here so chipper because you're ready to get to your Astro-isk, knowing full well that this hurts my heart so, as someone who was on the air when the Astros won the World Series in Houston, Texas.
Got an Astro-isk.
In 2017. Stop ruining my memories, Daniel. But I can't blame you. I have to blame the Astros. They went crazy.
How crazy did they go? There's two things that are interesting to me about this, and I find that the topic of cheating fascinating in sports. We praise the competitiveness of players. It's one of the traits that we admire most. It's something that is, Pete will tell you, is the cornerstone of his entire program. Competition. And yet there is a very clear line in most people's minds, even if they can't enunciate it specifically, between competing and cheating. That there's a very specific difference that's there. I think this is interesting because it allows us to flesh this out a little bit. There's also questions of integrity and all these different things and justice. How do you dole out punishment? How do you dole out punishment in what is an arbitrary league where we've agreed that these things mean something and championships are important and all these different things? How do you actually punish people? Let's start with the big picture. How bad is this cheating?
This is worse than Spygate. This is something that started, became more and more nuanced as time went on, and I think worst of all, when they were told to stop, they ignored the request to stop. Who that falls on, I'm not sure. I don't know that it should fall on AJ Hinch and Jeff Luhnow. Honestly, it feels like Alex Cora is the most guilty man alive in baseball these days, and he doesn't even get fired. It's a mutual parting of ways.
Well, he just agrees to go away, right? He's not going to work in his job. He probably won't be a manager again. Is this worse than steroids? That's the other cheating scandal. Is it worse than steroids?
I think you have to ask, how deep does the rabbit hole go on this front? Because with steroids, it feels like there was at least one player on every single team that was using performance enhancement drugs to turn into these V-shaped 1990s DC comic-esque figures. Where with this, I think that this is limited to contenders, but I do think that this is a lot more across the sport than we'd like to admit, and I think that's why baseball has come out with these punishments and why baseball has been telling all these organizations to, even with their complaining, zip it.
That part is PR, right? That part is just trying to manage the damage that's been done by this. That telling the, and you can debate the merits, like, is that a good strategy? It's a strategy they've adopted to try and minimize the damage that the discussion of this has come. My initial reaction is that I think worse of someone who participated in this sign stealing than I do of someone who abused steroids. I say that knowing that I might be guilty of reacting stronger to something that's more recently in front of me, and I might have sort of a fuzzy moral compass when it comes to steroids. That might be something that's a flaw of me, because I don't see it as a moral failing. I see it as guys crossing a line that's there, but I don't see it as, I don't think that a person who decided to use steroids is a bad person. It's hard for me to think that someone who participated in this and is banging on a trash can to tell a teammate what pitch is coming, that person's not at his core pretty dishonest. That there's an element there of, and maybe it's because there's a clearer cut victim in this case. And so I'm a simpleton, and I can't wrap my head around the opportunity cost of steroids taking away from guys who are competing cleanly. And oh, you don't know this is, hey, I'm going to tell you what he's throwing by using this thing, and you listen for the trash can smash, and that will give you an advantage. Where it's just, if somebody told me that, if somebody told me they use steroids, I would say that I don't think that's a good idea. I certainly think that there are long-term costs of that that you might not get. But I'm not going to say, man, you are misguided. If someone told me that they banged on a trash can to let their teammate know which pitch is coming, I'd like, that's low down dirty.
You would laugh first, but right. You would say it's low down dirty.
I would laugh, but I would just like, why are you doing that? That's some low-grade juvenile behavior.
It would take me a while to probably feel that it's low-grade juvenile behavior because, again, they're banging on trash cans. I'm with you on the performance enhancement drug. I've always felt that if you're willing to put this stuff in your body, there will be long-term consequences. I think in the case of HGH, we're not really 100% sure what those are. But I think in the case of steroids, it is well documented. Your body is going to start falling apart. You're going to lose your hair. Certain things are going to get smaller. You're going to be a more ornery, angry person. For this, my big question is, how many players knew this was happening and had an actual opposition to what was happening? Because Mike Fiers clearly was one. Mike Fiers, yes, is how this story all came to be.
And he talks to The Athletic, and he's going to get blackballed. You watch and see what happens. There's going to be a lot of players that are going to be very mad at him. I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's right. But I think that will happen. You're right.
I think it is important to note he did take the World Series ring. For all the issues he had, he did take the World Series ring.
That's actually pretty funny that to back up his status as a whistleblower, he needs to forego the benefits of said cheating that he found so objectionable.
I mean, if he had such a problem with it, I mean, I don't know, maybe give the ring back, but whatever. Okay, you keep the ring. I think I would, if I were in the same situation, if I had been a whistleblower, I'd probably keep the ring too, because I don't think I'm getting a job in baseball anytime soon. But how many other players felt this way, felt that this was wrong, saw this happening in the background, and just like in A Few Good Men, thought to themselves, this is messed up.
The interesting thing about that is there were, and there's one on this team, on Seattle's team, Marco Gonzalez, who spoke up about it. And
right.
Logan Morrison, who was a previous Mariner, had a post that he ended up taking down because of this, everyone being instructed to not talk about it, basically saying, it's clear that there are players in the league who knew it was happening or had an idea it was happening, who thought it was wrong, and are now very, very mad about it and almost think that there wasn't the punishment. Because there's that big picture, how bad is this cheating? And then there's the smaller picture, and this is really more of a question of justice and how do we administer sports leagues, is how it's handled. How does that stack up? No players have been punished.
It's ridiculous. That, I think, is the weirdest part of all.
No players have been punished. And they're essentially punishing the lifeguards because the kids got out of control in the pool. And, like, you should have known, the players are being treated like children that couldn't help themselves.
Doesn't it feel like it's the players' fault?
Yes.
Now, A.J. Hinch, he probably should have done something about it if he had such an issue with it. And I have a hard time buying Jeff Luhnow anything he says. I think he's a liar. But those guys seem a lot more removed from it than Carlos Beltran, who was playing for the Astros at the time and who was considered to be a key member of that clubhouse, especially with his ability to determine whether or not Yu Darvish was tipping pitches. That was a big deal in the World Series against the Dodgers. It was brought up often. Well, maybe he was really helping out when he found that Yu Darvish was tipping pitches by going and banging on a trash can. It's one of those things where Beltran was involved. Alex Cora, barely removed from the game, was involved. How many other players knew about it and were like, yeah, this is a great idea? And I think I heard a rant by Chris Mad Dog Russo about this whole thing. And he was saying, like, Justin Verlander, he's always got something to say. He doesn't have anything to say right now. Well, it's a fair point, because you think Justin Verlander didn't know about this stuff? I think there are a lot of players that knew about it. And I'm sure that there were a lot of players that were like, yeah, this is a brilliant idea.
It sounded like you got something caught in your pants zipper when you started screeching like Mad Dog.
Well, that's Mad Dog. That's how he sounds. He's a yapping little Yorkie poo.
It's Danny and Gallant. We're going to talk about some of the cheating scandal, where this fits in. We'll also get into some of the decisions that the Seattle Seahawks may make, including one guy who has walked away from the game that should give us cause for questions about a guy that's on the Seahawks roster. But right now, it's time to tell you what to watch for.
What to Watch For every morning at 7:10. Brought to you by Dubin Law Group. The first look at the stories worth watching today with Danny and Gallant.
WNBA has a new collective bargaining agreement with its players, which in many ways signals a victory for the players. More money is going to them. The salary cap is going up 30%. The high player max salary doesn't quite double, but it's like 40% increase. There's additional compensation. I think this is a good step for the league. And Sue Bird, who has, she's not just an elder statesman in the league, but someone who has been a pioneer, talked about the importance of this. I think the WNBA has been a huge benefit to our country, to the sporting scene, certainly to Seattle with how successful they've been. And I think it's great to see the business itself taking strides from what was something that was largely supported and funded by the NBA to start with.
I also think it's noteworthy, too, that the salary goes up. That means, I would imagine, less people have the need to go overseas and play basketball like so many of these players in the WNBA do. Also, there were some pretty messed up things as far as, what, like maternity leave and things of that nature, right? I don't know if you know the specifics of that, but it does seem like there's finally some much-needed progress in the sport.
Yeah, the working moms portion of the new agreement allows players to receive full salary while on maternity leave, which means they weren't. New
That's
annual
nuts.
Child care stipend and new progressive family planning benefits up to $60,000 reimbursement for veteran players. That can go anything from adoption, surrogacy, cryo, preservation, fertility. There is a lot of new things coming in here.
It's in a league where everyone can be a mother. That's nuts that this is finally happening. It's 2020.
Well, and I think that speaks to, quite honestly, that you had a league that was largely being governed by, and when it started, was being governed by and controlled by a league that was run by men
right.
in the NBA.
Yeah.
I think this is a great step for the WNBA.
What to watch for.
If you are a binge watcher, you will have a true crime series that involves sports on Netflix now. Because Netflix released a 3-part documentary on former New England Patriot Aaron Hernandez. This is going to be, I think, very interesting to watch. As someone who watched Aaron Hernandez play as a fan, not only for the Patriots, but at Florida, this is really going to be fascinating because his Florida stories, I really want to know what was happening there. Florida overlooks a lot of things, and they really looked the other way when it came to Hernandez on a variety of different things. That's why he fell to the second round and why the Patriots were able to bring him in. And the ability that he had to convince the New England Patriots that all of that stuff was in the past, also really fascinating. Can't wait to watch this.
What to watch for.
Alex Cora. He's gone as manager. He just agreed to leave. And this just isn't going to work out. I'll go away. You guys don't have to fire me, and I don't really quit. This isn't going to work.
Is this essentially a polite way of banning him for life? Because
yes,
I
don't think he'll work in baseball again.
I don't think he should, because he clearly was ignoring the memo that baseball sent out in 2017. And after the Red Sox had been punished the year before, the new manager of the Red Sox, here they win the World Series, so I guess they don't mind it that much, is bringing maybe not the trash can banging, but some of the same stuff to the Sox.
Do you think that was part of the? Do you think that was part of the interview process?
Did you bang the trash can?
No. The part of the interview process is: can you help us do what you were doing in Houston? He's like, oh yeah, we'll get it all set up. We're gonna have a video camera that's gonna be wired straight into the clubhouse, and then we're gonna get a trash can sat there that we're gonna smash on it. And sometimes people don't know this. I mean, there's nuances to it. Sometimes you can use a massage gun, like, you know, one of those little vibrating hard rubber ball gun-looking things. Yeah, instead of using a bat, just take that and smash it into the trash can.
There are two organizations in sports that I have bad feelings for because I have seen how the sausage is made. One of them is the Houston Rockets. The other one is the Boston Red Sox. So it's nice to see the Red Sox get a little punishment for this as well.
I don't get Boston's antagonism toward the Red Sox, and because there are a lot of Patriot fans that don't like the Red Sox.
It's because the Red Sox go out of their way to basically smear the Patriots whenever they can because they're jealous.
Yeah, it's just a smear campaign. They didn't do anything. Bad PR.
You should read a Boston Globe article that is about the New England Patriots because they are owned by the Boston Red Sox. That's all.
But see, that part is insane.
Right.
That part is no. The part where Patriot fans or people in Boston think that the Globe is influenced because the owner of the paper owns the Red Sox. That's insane. No, I know it is. The idea that that owner influences his paper is insane. It's crazy. It's absolutely nuts.
You think it doesn't?
No, there's no way it does.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so you think that John Henry's coming down in there and say, well, this is the column that you're going to write on the New England Patriots. Publishers don't even set foot inside most of their pages.
Danny, I mean, if you want to know just how petty this organization is, really just go back to when they fired Terry Francona, start there, and then just look at everything that has involved that team since then. Because releasing that Terry Francona was doing pills and going through a divorce as a reason for the 2011 collapse and using him as a scapegoat before hiring Bobby Valentine was one of the most ridiculous things that has ever happened, considering that guy won the first World Series for that franchise in 86 years. I know it sounds crazy, but that is how small-minded and petty that team is, and they have a firm grasp over that newspaper.
That all might be very true. That has nothing to do with who owns the Boston Globe. Zero to do with who owns the Boston Globe.
Okay, whatever you got to tell yourself.
It's Danny and Gallant. We got John Clayton. It's time for the Morning Drive.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
Presented by Infinity of Tacoma at 5.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Professor, good morning.
Boy, it's a busy morning.
It is a very busy morning. What did you make of Luke Kuechly deciding to walk away from the NFL?
I'm not surprised because I guess you can see with the concussions that he's had through the years and the fact that he's put so much into the game, the body's just telling him, kind of like Rob Gronkowski, maybe it's time to get out of it. And so where that's huge is that basically says that the Panthers are going to be in a rebuilding mode because, Greg Olsen's probably going to retire. They have to figure out what to do with Cam Newton. And, it's going to be interesting to see what Jadeveon Clowney thinks about this because, if they were going to go back to a 4-3, that might have been a team that he might consider. But he wants to go to a winning team. Well, it looks like next year they're not going to be a winning team without Kuechly, without Olsen, and whatever other changes they're going to make.
Also, Larry Fitzgerald coming back for a 17th season. It's an incredible career that he's already had. And I think it's great that he's coming back. Who doesn't like watching Larry Fitzgerald play?
Well, all I know is that how many years now have the Seahawks played Arizona in Week 17? And because Larry always is going to walk over to me either before or during the start of a game, I always say the same thing. It's like, hey, make sure you don't retire. Make sure you come back. And, of course, I mean, some years he's kind of looking like he's listening, but he's listened every year. And I think it's great for the game to have him back. He's one of the great players in NFL history. He's one of the great ambassadors for the game. And, again, I guess the bad news for Seattle, he's still there, a Hall of Famer at wide receiver.
John, what's the point of the Rooney Rule? Because we only saw one minority head coach hired this offseason in Ron Rivera. We haven't really seen a whole lot of minority assistant coaches hired as coordinators either. Why has it gone to this level, and are they going to make any changes?
Yeah, they have to make some changes because at this stage, it's just not working as well as it should, and not even close. I mean, to a point where Troy Vincent from the league office basically says it's an embarrassment what's going on right now. And so one of the things that they need to do is they need to find a better way to get coordinators, minority coordinators, particularly on offense. Because, one, you can't force owners to hire people that they don't want to hire. Okay, that's one thing that we know for sure. And so you have to put enough incentives in there to put people in position to be ready to be head coaches. And so you see so few coordinators. Like, for example, Eric Bieniemy should be hired at some point out of Kansas City, but he doesn't call plays. And so that kind of works against him. You got Byron Leftwich down in Tampa Bay, but you need a system right now where you have guys move coordinators. I don't know. One suggestion would be that any coach that's under contract who's a minority has the ability to move to a position that, because you can't do that right now. If you're under contract, they can say no if you even want to promote you to be coordinator. They need to get more coordinators, so they need to open that up, and they need to try to find a way to make this work better.
It's disappointing because we've seen the number of minority coaches shrink, and that's the exact opposite of what you would expect from a rule, that once those barriers were broken, that it would go and everything would change. And hey, everybody, there have been incredibly successful African-American coaches, and that should increase the opportunities. When those opportunities start to shrink and you start to wonder, okay, what's really going on here? Because sometimes what you think is going to be a landmark moment turns out to kind of be more of an aberration. And it certainly seems like there's a little bit of that's what's going on, that the opportunities are constricting rather than expanding.
Well, then the problem is that it's set up more for the interviews than it is for getting people ready to be head coaches. And that's where the effort needs to be. You know, for example, it's like, you look at what happened in Dallas and you look at what happened in Carolina. You know, they brought in Marvin Lewis for an interview, and basically he was the minority. I mean, he was the Rooney Rule. I mean, he complied with that. They also had the interim coach Perry Fuel interviewed, but that was it. It's like, it's the interview. What they need to do is more of a broadband thing in developing and making sure that you get, you know, even maybe what it comes down to is that when you're hiring coordinators, you have to have the Rooney Rule involved with that to interview. But the problem is there's not enough guys who are coordinators that are going to qualify. So they need to put the effort into building coordinators and guys that are going to be ready to be head coaches. That's where the problem is. You only have Byron Leftwich, which I believe might be the only minority play caller. That's weak.
Speaking of coordinators, the Panthers hired LSU's Joe Brady. It seems like we're getting closer and closer to all these coaching staffs being finalized. Anything else surprising like that on the horizon?
I'm sure there are going to be a few more surprises down the line because, again, there's a lot more hires that need to be done. And I think you can see on the flip side, what ends up happening is I think owners overestimate what you're going to get as far as assistant coaches. And where I say that, you look at now how many of the first-year coaches ended up firing guys, coordinators, and all those different things. Denver fired their coordinator. Miami, you know, changed coordinators on defense. And all those different things come into play right now. And so, there's going to be some surprises. The thing that's going to be interesting about Joe Brady coming up to Carolina, David Tepper is going to be one of the most aggressive owners in football. Okay. You know that maybe Joe Burrow may not want to go to Cincinnati. So what if, you know, he puts down an Eli Manning type edict like he did in 2004 and didn't want to go to the Chargers and then say, you know, put himself up to bid, and all of a sudden here comes Carolina to do this. I think that, you know, there's a great relationship with Brady and Burrow, and we'll kind of see where that goes.
How sure are we that Joe Burrow is going to be phenomenal? And I ask that. He's 24 years old,
yeah,
and he hadn't had a breakout season until this year. A year ago at this time, everybody was talking about how Trevor Lawrence was going to be the best quarterback prospect ever. How much of Joe Burrow's reputation is that we are basing it on what we've seen most recently as opposed to what we can expect from him going forward?
Hard to say because, again, he doesn't have the strongest arm. He's certainly a system type of quarterback, so we really don't know. You know, I think, you know, when you're talking about Lawrence, I mean, I think that hasn't changed. I mean, he still looks like, you know, the next all of, and Andrew Luck. I mean, that's where the ratings are with him, so it's going to still stay high. But I would have to say right now that, I still wonder about it. I mean, you look at the success in college and it's there, but will it carry into the NFL? Good debate, but still at this stage, he's considered the number one pick in the draft.
Titans head coach Mike Vrabel had told his players on a podcast that he wasn't going to cut off his own Mike Vrabel to win a Super Bowl. But now he's saying to Sports Illustrated that he's not going to do that. Do you think he's perhaps jinxed his chances of a title?
No, because, again, he's going against a better team, so I don't think that plays into it at all. But now I don't understand what it is. Mike Vrabel?
Yeah, his Mike Vrabel.
He's going to change.
All right, we're done with that. Moving on.
Jez, do you understand that at all?
Unfortunately, I do, John, but believe me, you don't have to continue on this conversation.
Oh, okay, now I get it. Okay,
glad I could bring some clarity
to
this.
I don't know if that's going to be, I don't know if Andy Reid's going to lay down and allow that to happen and let him go to the Super Bowl without his Mike Vrabel.
Professor, we always appreciate it, especially when you bring that level of analysis. We look forward to catching up with you tomorrow.
Thanks, okay, thanks. John.
That is the morning drive with the professor, John Clayton. Are you happy, Paul? You seem very pleased with yourself.
Well, listen, I mean, you got your terrible little, what was it,
Astro-isk
line in there, and I got my line in there. So we're both happy. We're happy little campers.
It's Danny and Gallant. Luke Kuechly and Bobby Wagner entered the league together. The fact that Kuechly is retiring, it points out the risk the Seahawks have taken in re-signing Wagner. Where is that at right now? We'll talk about it next on Danny and Gallant.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Luke Kuechly walking away from the NFL yesterday was pretty surprising, even for a guy that has suffered as many concussions as he probably has suffered. Luke Kuechly announced this via a message that he sent out to the old people of Twitter last night.
You know, there's only one way to play this game since I was a little kid is to play fast and play physical and play strong. And at this point, I don't know if I'm able to do that anymore. And that's the part that is the most difficult is. I still want to play, but I don't think it's the right decision. So thought about it for a long time, and I think now is an opportunity for me to step away with what's going on here.
Not even 30 years old, Danny, and it continues a trend where middle linebackers like Patrick Willis, Chris Borland are walking away from the game well before they turn 30.
There's certainly something to be said about how the increased understanding of the impact of head injuries and, for that matter, injuries to the rest of your body, and the higher amounts of money that are involved in today's game, how that's going to change the career expectancy for some of the best players. I don't think you'll necessarily see as many players sort of riding till the wheels fall off and saying, hey, I'm going to play this game until my body absolutely cannot do it on a day-to-day basis anymore. I think that's good in the sense that you want players to be making the decisions that they're happy with in their own best interest. If they want to play until they can't play anymore, hey, that's their choice. They're grown men. If they want to say that, hey, I've made a lot of money to live comfortably and I don't want to compromise my quality of life at the end of it, that's a great decision too. Like, you want people to make educated, informed decisions.
I 100% agree, and all the power in the world to these guys who are playing this position. But it did make me think for a second. The Seahawks' highest paid defensive player is Bobby Wagner. Bobby Wagner got a 3-year, $54 million extension for himself with $40.2 million guaranteed this past offseason. And as someone who is coming in, not having watched all of Bobby Wagner's career, but understanding that Bobby Wagner is one of the better linebackers in the NFL, if not the best middle linebacker in the NFL. It's a little strange, just given the current trend at that position, to have a linebacker approaching 30 as your highest paid defensive player, especially when I look at this past season, and I know he's an all-pro, but I don't know that he necessarily had the same kind of impact that being an all-pro player merits.
There's two things that I think are worth pointing out here. The first is that I'm not as concerned about the money Seattle spent on Bobby Wagner for this reason. I think your money goes further when you're paying to retain your own players. In today's NFL economy, your money goes further when you're retaining your own players because you're able to extend them earlier. You're able to offer them some security, and therefore you're getting a better player for the same price. The money that they spent on Bobby Wagner would have bought them, what, C.J. Mosley on the open market? Bobby Wagner's a better player than C.J. Mosley.
I agree.
You get more for your money when you re-sign your own because the best players in the NFL do not make it to free agency. They don't get out on the market. So that's the first part. That second question of, did you get what you paid for? I think that that's an interesting question as well. I'm not certain of the answer. I think Bobby Wagner had a pretty good year.
I think he had a pretty good year as well, but in coverage, I think there was a lot left to be desired, and I think that's why you're paying him that kind of money, is because he's a versatile, well-rounded linebacker as opposed to, I don't know, someone in Houston, say like a Bednarik Bikini, who got a similar kind of contract, and I also scratched my head at that within the last 2 years. because this is a guy that was more of a run thumper. He is one of those guys that is great in run support, but in coverage, okay, yeah, you could do better probably. I get the deal from a leadership standpoint, and I think you're right, Danny, in that re-signing your own guy does go a long way. I think it shows also that you're willing to take care of your own, especially when there's someone who's been with the organization for a long period of time and you're giving him something like this. But I do wonder, okay, does any linebacker have the ability to have the kind of impact that that kind of contract would ask for going forward, just in today's NFL in 2020? I'm not 100% sure on that. And I do wonder, in an offseason where you're probably going to have to pay Jadeveon Clowney a lot of money and hurt your cap figure on that front, and on top of that, where you might be looking to sign another key defensive player in free agency, cornerback, that's top of the market kind of money. If you do see a cornerback out there that you really like, it doesn't always work out when you sign a cornerback, but I do think that should be something the Seahawks leave open for themselves. Also, potentially at offensive line, you're giving a lot at middle linebacker. I'm not necessarily saying that this is a miss or a mistake that they gave that contract out. I just look at Luke Kuechly, a guy who walked away, and I look at Bobby Wagner, a guy who's approaching 30 years old, playing a position like this, and I do wonder just about going forward if this is something that might hurt them.
I certainly thought that it's worrisome that they're signing him to a third contract. I thought the lesson from 2015 to 2017 for the Seahawks was no more third contracts. Didn't work with Cam Chancellor, didn't work with Marshawn Lynch, didn't work with Michael Bennett. Like, there's been a whole list of guys, Cliff Avril, also included in that list, some of it because of injury, some of it because of sort of citizenship, that when you extend a guy past when he's going to be 30, that you're basically betting against the likely career arc of players in the NFL. Did Seattle miss by not re-signing Earl Thomas, though? Because I've heard the exact same argument of, hey, Seattle screwed up by not bringing him back. Does Baltimore, and it kind of becomes this zero, that we react to the overall performance of the defense rather than the wisdom of the actual signing. Seattle might value veteran defensive players more than it should. That's possible, and you can make an argument for that. I don't know, though, by going all young, and when you see that they haven't had guys behind the safeties that they've had, that's a compelling argument either, because they're certainly not going to be a better team without Bobby Wagner, and in fact, they might have been significantly worse.
Yeah, I'm with you on that front, because this is a young defense that needed somebody to be in the middle that I think would bring it all together and help everyone get up to speed. Like someone like Jadeveon Clowney, even. You need to have someone out there that knows what the defense is, and maybe you can talk to and communicate with on a play, especially as you're trying to pick up the playbook when you just get traded to the team, what, like a week before the season begins. So I understand, like, on that front, but I do wonder, you know, you mentioned Earl Thomas. How does that game go against the Packers with an Earl Thomas back there? Because, and say you still make the trade for Quandre Diggs. You can move Quandre Diggs into certain spots where you don't have Ugo Amadi or Lane O'Hill getting beaten. And those are the two guys that probably lost you the game.
Well, you also have Earl Thomas didn't keep the Baltimore Ravens from losing to the Tennessee Titans.
True.
At home. So it's not like this. And that's what I mean by,
but
you can always, you know, you can always pick and choose of, hey, the result of this season didn't go as well as we wanted. What was the problem? Oh, well, Bobby Wagner wasn't as good as he was supposed to be because he was on the team, and you can't say that, his absence. But Earl Thomas, well, he left for somewhere else. So maybe if he had been here, he's the difference. It becomes where you're not diagnosing what the individual player is doing. You're judging the player based on the guys around him, which isn't at all fair.
Right. And I'm not trying to get into the what would have, should have, because we can go down a giant rabbit hole with that. I do think with Earl Thomas, it's important to note that they went up against just a freak of a running back that doesn't exist in the NFC. This is something that only exists in the AFC. That's an AFC problem. And Earl Thomas, he chirped a lot. He didn't have anything to really say with his actual oomph when it comes to tackling a Derrick Henry. But for a guy like Bobby Wagner, in a division like the NFC West, which does have a team that can run the football in the San Francisco 49ers, but seems to be much more quarterback-oriented going forward, it is interesting the amount of money that they have going towards him going forward, especially when linebackers are retiring before the age of 30, left and right. Danny and Gallant, Danny O'Neill, Paul Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle. There's one thing that the Seahawks absolutely must address on offense this offseason, even if Danny refuses to acknowledge it. And there's something that happened yesterday that I think is even more of an indication that it needs to happen. We'll tell you what we're talking about next. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
the Seahawks begin an offseason in which they have to, wait for it, improve the offensive line. Russell Wilson sacked more than any... I don't know if I can do this.
Why can't you do this? You're such a, well, it's not just the offensive line's fault with
no,
sacks
it's not
guy.
That. Dude, I've done this... This is at least the fourth offseason where I'm going to spend the better part of 3 months talking about the importance of improving the offensive
this
line.
This is the offseason, though, Danny.
And I've watched the entire life cycle happen twice where I've praised the selection of James Carpenter of the Seahawks set out to improve the one thing they had to address. They drafted a tackle, and then they got John Moffitt, and then Carpenter became the problem they had to replace, and then they finally got it right. They went and took Jermaine Ifedi in the first round, and now
he's leaving.
I'm at the point of Groundhog Day where Bill Murray just gives up and starts throwing the toaster in the bath as soon as the day starts.
Oh, wow.
Like, can I just skip this whole thing?
Do I
have to do it? Yeah, I do feel dark. I'm going to spend the next 3 months talking about the need and how they've got to protect their quarterback, and he's a franchise quarterback. Russell can't get hit so much. And then they're going to draft a guy, and I'm going to go, I've never heard of his name before. Nobody's ever talked about him. They say he's a reach, but these guys must know what they're doing, right? No, all evidence is they don't really know how to pick a lineman that will fix it. And then we'll spend all the next year talking about how Russell's getting hit too much.
Well, just because they don't know how to do it doesn't mean that they shouldn't go after finding someone that can help protect Russell Wilson. He was the most sacked quarterback in the NFL, tied with Matt Ryan and Kyler Murray this past year. Dwayne Brown's 34 and coming off of knee surgery. Jermaine Ifedi's a free agent. Like, just based off of, okay, let's get someone to replace Dwayne Brown in the future. Why not? George Fant is also a free agent. And I think this is most noteworthy, Danny. Yesterday, Chandler Jones won the NFC's Defensive Player of the Year award with 19 sacks. And remember, he had 4 sacks against the Seahawks in that awful, 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 awful game at CenturyLink where the Cardinals, led by Brett Hundley, a real quarterback, decimated the Seahawks.
Does that mean that the Seahawks get a share of that? Like when Chandler Jones gets up to accept his award, he goes, I'd like to thank the Seattle Seahawks and specifically Jamarco Jones.
Let's be honest,
for this
award. That probably is why he won the award. 4 sacks at that point of the year, especially when I think Shaquille Barrett might have been close to having the sack lead in the NFC this past season. That was massive to get 4 sacks at the end of the year. It was almost like Brett Favre giving Michael Strahan a little dive to give him the sack record.
All right, so Dwayne Brown's still under contract, so you don't have to worry about that. George Fant and Jermaine Ifedi are both going to be unrestricted free agents. You can't afford to bring both of them back. At least I can't imagine. I think somebody's going to decide that George Fant can be a starter. And certainly
maybe
Someone's going to look at Jermaine Ifedi. I don't feel like you should pay. You shouldn't close the door on either one of those guys going back, but I don't think you get into a bidding war on either one.
You're in a tough spot because you're also drafting at the back of the first round. And I think something that we have seen of late is that teams are willing to draft and trade up to draft offensive linemen around about pick 20. So where are you picking? To pick 27, I believe it is. That's going to make it really difficult. It might be a little bit earlier than that, seeing as they are a wild card team, but they did get to the second round. I'll be honest, off the top of my head, I don't know. But what I do know is that is a tricky area when it comes to drafting linemen. That is one of those spots where you might have an eye on somebody, but you could end up being like the Houston Texans last year who wanted Andre Dillard, having the Philadelphia Eagles trade up a pick in front of them and get Andre Dillard. So then you have to settle for someone like Titus Howard.
Oh, God, if we didn't get a player like Andre Dillard who got benched after the first half of the Seahawks game.
If you're not
able to draft a player like Andre Dillard who got manhandled by Ziggy Ansah, the only person to have that happen
cool,
to him,
man.
I don't know where this is going to go next season.
Okay.
I really don't know. But I have some serious questions about everybody involved in this operation. If they can't draft in the first round an offensive tackle who gets benched at half.
Blah, blah, blah. Oh, I'm a nihilist about offensive linemen. Look, here's the deal. You need someone. Dwayne Brown's 34, and you don't have anyone else. You're in a division with Aaron Donald. You're in a division that theoretically has the Rams with Clay Matthews next year, though he would be an easy cap cut. I think Dante Fowler's gone. He's a free agent and had 11.5 sacks. Nick Bosa, DeForest Buckner, and Dee Ford. And if the 49ers bring Eric Armstead back, who's also a free agent, there's a lot of pass rushers in this division. And Russell Wilson was sacked 44 times this year. You got to bring somebody in. This is a fact.
Paul, you're right. They do need to bring somebody in. my question and my issue is, do I have to talk about it?
Yes.
Or can I just record something that will play every time that the offensive line discussion comes up? And then you can just hear my voice droning on. And the benefit of that will be is that we can put it in a file and save it and use it again next offseason, because it's probably going to be the exact same thing that we're going to be talking about. And maybe we can splice it so we can change and edit the names. But
so who is it on?
There's 10 years of history now to prove to the fact. Is it
John Schneider? Is it Pete Carroll? Is it the offensive line coach? Who is the reason that they can't figure this out?
I don't know.
Okay, so that's what you should focus your efforts on. How about you
figuring out who's at fault. They've changed offensive line coaches. They've now had three there. The guy that they've got was initially on the staff when Pete got the job and Mike Solari, but they decided he was going to coach tight ends because Alex Gibbs would come here. So they've had three different guys who have worked with the offensive line, and it's kind of been a problem the whole time. It's also the personnel department gets it, but they're pretty good at other positions, and it doesn't seem like they're absolutely clueless there. So maybe, you know what? I think it's the offense and the quarterback. I think that's why Russell gets sacked a lot, is because he holds on to the ball, and I don't want to change the quarterback.
I think
sacks are a quarterback stat.
No, I see. I knew you were going to come back to this, but it's not just a quarterback stat. Come on. It's a little of both, right? It's a little of both.
You know how long he held the ball on average?
He held it very long. He extends plays.
5 seconds. It was 5 seconds to sack. That was the average on the times he was sacked on Sunday. That's the longest of any quarterback. He holds the ball a long time, so he gets sacked a lot. Ergo, it's the quarterback's fault, and the trade-off is fine.
You're just saying this so you don't have to talk about it.
It's possible. It's possible that I'm looking at it that way. But it's also, I think there is something to it. Like, that's what's been the most consistent thing over the past 8 seasons. It's been the quarterback. What's been the most consistent trait on the offense is that he gets sacked a lot. All the offensive linemen have changed, and the offensive line coach has changed. The one thing that stayed the same is the quarterback.
You have seen the same thing from the Houston Texans this past year. They trade for Laremy Tunsil. They upgrade their offensive line, and yet Deshaun Watson's still getting sacked a whole lot. He got sacked a whole lot against Kansas City. He's getting sacked pretty much every single game that he plays in. So that's also a part of his game, too, and maybe this is just a mobile quarterback thing. But I do think that there is something to be said for getting an offensive line that is not going to get just absolutely steamrolled right off of the snap, so that Russell Wilson has time to get those 5 seconds before he eventually takes the sack.
Wait a minute. Were we watching the same team? Because the problem with this team wasn't the offense. The problem was the defense. They should use every draft pick they have to get better defensive players.
But you have a bunch of young players that are rookies on your defense, basically going
good?
Into their second
are
year.
Are they any good? Why did they play if they're any good?
Cody Barton's good.
Cody Barton is good.
I think that there's something there with Marquise Blair. Ugo Amadi, I'm really not sure, but I like the potential there. There are enough young pieces on the defensive end of things that I don't think you can just focus on entirely the defense this offseason. I think that there is definitely room as well to look at the long-term side of your offense. You have to get somebody that can play tackle. You do. You just don't have one right now.
It's Danny and Gallant. We'll bring in Michael Bump to see if he can make me talk about the offensive line or stop being a pouty little baby. One of the two. It's Danny and Gallant. That's next. Blue 42.